Griffin Show, where we talk about government, music, art, health, science, ufology, religion, metaphysics, and all things spiritual. In short, we'll examine the truth. And when we find things that aren't right, we'll offer creative solutions. And now, the host of Evidence Footprints, Don Nikoloff.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to Evident Footprints on BBSRadio.com. I'm your host, Don Nikoloff, and I will be with you for the next hour on this June the 18th on the West Coast, June the 19th on the East Coast, and in the Central Time Zone. So nice to have all you folks with us, as well as all the folks around the world, especially in the U.S. military, who have been recently tuning into this show. Pretty much ever since I brought Drew Malone Raines III on as a guest, and he was our guest last night, and we were all over the board last night. I hope the show made some sense. Just so many things to talk about, but we are going to talk about railroads tonight. What do I mean, railroads? Well, some people fly, some people like to take a car, and some people like to enjoy the scenery of the country. They'll buy a ticket. They'll get on a train. If they're lucky, it's a sleeper car. They get first-class dining, and they travel the scenic route of the railway system. Of course, we have brought out on this show that the railway system is owned by foreign entities and always has been in the United States. And we may do a show just on the tracks some night, but tonight we're going to talk about a certain individual that was taken on a railroad ride through the legal system, and we are going to address this issue because it's a famous case, and yet many in our listening audience may never have heard of this case. On the show tonight to discuss this story and some other things is our good friend. He has his own website, educate-yourself.org, which is read by millions every month around the world. And he is a metaphysical scientist, an inventor of sorts. He is also a fine journalist and investigative researcher. A reader of many books, many documents, and he's our good friend, Mr. Ken Adachi. Ken, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Don. A pleasure to be on with you again.
Well, I'm sure you're excited to talk about railroads tonight, and we're we're going to talk about a particular trip that an individual took on the railroad without even having bought a ticket.
Very good.
And so I turn the microphone over to you to at least introduce this topic, and we'll have an exchange back and forth, I'm sure.
Okay. I want to talk about the case of a man by the name of Dr. Jeffrey R. McDonald. Dr. McDonald is a medical doctor in 1970. He was also in the Army and stationed on Fort Bragg in North Carolina. He was a young man. He had graduated from Princeton, attended medical school, and then had gotten married while he was still going to college at the age of 19 to a woman named Colette Stevenson. And upon finishing school, he went into the Army. And he was eventually given the rank of Army Captain. And he trained as a Green Beret, which is a group of special forces part of the Army. So in addition to his trained work as a physician, he also trained in a combat role as a Green Beret. He was very skilled in his training, and he enjoyed the work, he enjoyed the life that he was living. And after many years of struggling financially, going through medical school and the like, and having a young wife, and first having one child, then a second child, he was assigned to Fort Bragg, I believe in the summer, late summer, early fall of 1969. And a horrendous event occurred in the early morning hours of February 17th, 1970. He had fallen asleep on the couch of the home they had, which was a military officer's home on the grounds of Fort Bragg. Fort Bragg is a little bit different from many military installations in that it is not surrounded by a wall, etc. It's a sort of installation that has many open areas with public roads running through it, but it is a military reservation all the same.
Mm-hmm.
And he had fallen asleep on the couch on the early morning hours of February 17th, because when he attempted to go to the bedroom where his wife is, they had two small children, a 2-year-old girl and a 7-year-old girl, who normally have their own beds and cribs to sleep in their bedroom. He wanted to go to bed with his wife, but the smallest child had crawled into bed with the mother earlier, before Jeff had gotten home that evening, and had fallen asleep with her mother, but because it's only a 2-year-old child, she had wetted the bed. So Jeff had lifted the 2-year-old to put her into her crib, but then discovered that the bed was wet. So what he did is he peeled back the sheets and the covers as best he could so he could air out. And he got a book, and he went to the living room, and he got a blanket, and he was reading a book with a light on a nightstand right next to his couch, and the TV was on. He fell asleep while reading the book. And approximately 2:15 or so a.m. in the morning, he was awoken by individuals, three men, standing over him, and as where he was staying on the couch. They started to address him, and they actually started to assault him. And, of course, he was dazed, but he recalls that about the same time these individuals had woken him up and were assaulting him, he heard his wife calling out his name from the bedroom. Now, the bedroom is located down a hallway. You'd have to go down a substantial hallway to get to the master bedroom, which was at the end of the hall, but he was in a front room where the living room was. But, of course, he was being held or, you know, engaged by these three individuals who were both talking to him, demanding things from him, but also assaulting him at the same time. One of them was hitting him with a club, and a little later on in the altercation, another man was stabbing him repeatedly. So he's being punched, assaulted, and stabbed and hit with a baseball bat by three men. He lost consciousness as a result of the beating of the baseball bat. A number of things had transpired with these three men. They had tried to get him to order some drugs for them from the base dispensary. They wanted him to call the dispensary to somehow they thought they could get him to order drugs, which would be delivered to his house. It's pretty unusual, but all these individuals were high on drugs who were in his house on that night. So people under that circumstances do and ask bizarre things.
Mm-hmm. If I can interject here with a question,
mm-hmm.
One would presume because they asked him specifically to get drugs from the base dispensary that they mm-hmm. knew not only who he was, but mm-hmm. but there was some intent prearranged, premeditated
mm-hmm. yes.
intent.
Yes, they certainly knew who he was because some of the individuals that were in the house, not the three men who were assaulting Jeff McDonald, but there was other men in the bedroom part of the house who were assaulting the wife and the children,
mm-hmm.
at least one of them, a man by the name of Greg Mitchell, was in the Army himself and knew well who Dr. Jeff McDonald was, because that same evening, within hours, or the prior evening of this event, on the evening of February 16th, this individual, Greg Mitchell, along with two others, accosted McDonald's wife, Colette, in a on-base education center. She was taking classes, I think, in psychology, you know, adult ed classes, I guess for credit. And she was pregnant, by the way, at the time, mm-hmm. with her third child. Anyway, they stopped her in the foyer of this adult ed center, and this guy, Greg Mitchell, specifically warned her to warn your husband to that he has to stop snitching on their friends. What this group who had entered the house were part of was a satanic drug coven, which is normally composed of 13 people. Ted Gunderson believes, along with the former detective from the Fayetteville, North Carolina police, who was instrumental in bringing out a great deal of information about the case, a man by the name of Prince Beasley, who has since died, believed there were a total of 8 individuals in the McDonald house on the night that his wife and 2 children were murdered. But McDonald himself only saw 3 individuals, the 3 men assaulting him, and during the course of the assault, he saw a woman by the name of Helena Stokely walk through the living room area holding a candle, and she was chanting a phrase, or a number of phrases. And that's the only persons that he saw or can recall seeing that night. But as I mentioned, Ted Gunderson, Prince Beasley, and others who have forensically examined the entire case believe there was a total of 8 individuals in the house that night. I won't go through all the details of the murder other than to say that the wife, Colette, was both beaten and stabbed to death, and her two children were also stabbed to death repeatedly. On the murderers did something especially heinous to the youngest child, in which they, using a knife, had in her chest carved a pentagram surrounded by a circle and stabbed her a certain number of times that had significance. I can't recall whether it's 13 stab wounds, I'm not sure, but they had literally carved a pentagram in a circle into her chest. They also wrote in blood on the headboard of Colette's bed, "Kill the pigs." If you recall, the Manson murders had taken place the previous summer, the summer of 1969, mm-hmm. and they had done the same thing.
And a pregnant woman, too.
Right, a pregnant woman, right. So there was copycat elements of a satanic-type murder ritual. Okay.
One would assume, just on that basis...
Yes,
and Sharon Tate was pregnant herself, Roman Polanski's wife, and I find it interesting that Polanski eventually fled the United States too, mm-hmm. Probably for his life, but nonetheless, I bring up that parallel because likely it's the same group of people behind it.
Well, they were Satanists. There's no question about mm-hmm. that because they. They referred to themselves and engaged in satanic practices, satanic rituals. And the individual who was part of that group, who was most instrumental in bringing out the greatest detail of the satanic and the drug activity of the group, was Helena Stokely,
mm-hmm.
who was in the McDonald apartment on the night of the murders. She was with the group prior to the murders, during the murders, and she was with this group following the murders. So she was a first-hand witness to all of the events leading up to the murder, and of course in the aftermath of the many years following. She engaged in, let's say, an attempt on numerous occasions over a number of years to try to reveal the truth about what happened that night. Helena Stokely, despite the fact that she was with this coven, despite the fact that she was involved in drug activity, she was a drug user herself, nevertheless, throughout her life, had a conscience. And it bothered her deeply that the wife and the children were murdered in the fashion that they were. And she felt deep remorse and regret that the father of the children, Jeff McDonald, was set up to be a patsy, to take the fall for the crime, which she knew perfectly well that the members of her group had committed that night.
Mm-hmm.
Now, there was a second individual I mentioned who surely participated in the butchering and murder of at least Colette, the wife, but may or may not have participated in the killing of the kids, because there was at least four males and perhaps a second female in the apartment, and they were likely in the bedroom section since Jeff McDonald was engaged with three males, and he saw Helena Stokely, who was walking through the various rooms. They were all high on drugs, on a lot of drugs, not just one. And this fellow Greg Mitchell, while he was a heck of a drug addict, he was a very, edgy sort of hair-trigger temper type guy, also in time came to feel the weight of the murders on his conscience. And because he was a very heavy user of drugs, and I guess alcohol too, he died at an early age. I think he died in 1983, which happens to be the same year that Helena Stokely died as well.
Mm-hmm.
And Greg Mitchell had confessed to more than one individual. For one, he confessed to his mother that he participated, but there was a couple that had taken him in under their wings. It was a Christian couple. I can't remember the name off the top of my head, but their names are in the book called Fatal Justice,
mm-hmm.
written by Jerry Potter and Fred Bost, which was published in 1995, but actually they began to write the book in 1985. It took them 10 years to complete their investigation to put together that book. It was a very thorough investigation into what really happened in the McDonald house that night. And if you want to know the true state of affairs and who the players are and who are the players involved in setting up and railroading Jeff McDonald to take the fall for these crimes, then you need to read Fatal Justice by Jerry Potter and Fred Bost, B-O-S-T.
Now, if I can interrupt here for a second.
Yeah.
For the listeners out there who are thinking to themselves, well, if you have an admission from at least two people that they participated in this murder, and there is no statute of limitations on murder anyway, why... you and I both know the reason why.
Yeah, I understand.
Why aren't these people being tried and McDonald being released?
Right. What had happened?
That's the most basic question, I think.
Right, the most basic question. Right, so I'll...
And Ted Gunderson, just for clarification, he would have been the special supervisory agent of the Los Angeles District of the FBI at that time? Or
let me explain.
The investigation?
Correct.
Okay.
Ted Gunderson had retired from the FBI in March of 1979.
Okay.
The trial of Jeffrey McDonald, although the murder occurred on February 17th of 1970, It wasn't until 1975 that McDonnell was indicted by a grand jury, and the actual trial of McDonnell took place in August of 1979, more than 7 years after the murder, okay? Ted Gunderson retired from the FBI in March of 1979, and he was now, after he retired from the FBI, had a long career with them. He went into work as a private investigator. And he was contacted by an individual who knew Jeff McDonnell, and he explained to Ted Gunderson that this is after the trial, by the way. The trial occurred in August of 79. He was found guilty. Jeff McDonnell was found guilty of the murder of his wife and two children and then sentenced to three consecutive life sentences. After that, Ted Gunderson was contacted by a friend of Jeff McDonnell and said, I've heard of your work and your reputation, and now that you're a private investigator, would you consider looking into this case?
Uh-huh.
So Ted knew nothing about the case. He said, sure. So what he did is he started to do some digging from his own resources, but then he simply went to see Jeff McDonnell in prison. I think at that time, I'm not sure, but I think he was imprisoned in the Terminal Island, which is here in Southern California. And he talked to him at length. And when he went to see him, he says, if I don't believe you, if I think you did it, then he says, I'm not going to get involved in the case at all, but I'll give you the chance to explain to me your side of the story. So Jeff McDonnell did that. And as Ted looked into the story, Ted quickly began to realize that McDonnell in no way was capable of committing this sort of crime, because he simply is not capable of murdering people, A. But B, there was so much evidence of judicial malfeasance, intentional prosecutorial misconduct on first the part of the Army who first investigated the murder and put McDonnell through a 3 months Army hearing in which he was totally exonerated from. So thankfully the Army colonel in charge of the hearing was a straight shooter, and he saw that the Army's Criminal Investigation Division, abbreviated CID, had essentially set up a series of strawman arguments to try to hang it on McDonnell, whereby the bona fide evidence clearly pointed to outsiders that enter his apartment. What happened is that the same year that he was acquitted by the Army, McDonnell left the Army. This is now the fall of 1970. McDonnell was encouraged by his father-in-law, a man by the name of Freddie Kassab, who had already gone to Washington to speak to congressional committees about investigating the Army for their attempt to try to frame McDonnell for the murders when a great deal of evidence was withheld from the defense teams, and a great deal of other evidence was not, laboratory evidence particularly, was simply not made known to the defense team. All these pieces of evidence could have exonerated McDonnell right out of the box had the prosecutor's office made them known to the defense. But it took years and years of requests via appeals, etc., for much of this evidence to become known to McDonnell's defense teams, who had changed over the years. Anyway, in 1970, December, Freddie Kassab, the father-in-law, along with a well-known person of the U.S. Congress, who often heads up committees, still is heading up committees to this day, encouraged McDonnell to go on the Dick Cavett show. Kassab apparently had written the producers and asked and told them about this story. So Dick Cavett invited Jeff McDonnell on that show. And on the show, you can find the video tubes presentation of this on YouTube, I believe.
And would that have been when Dick Cavett was on ABC CIA TV?
Correct. Right.
Or I should say ABCIA TV.
Right. That's when Dick Cavett was on ABC television, right?
And okay.
He had what was called the Dick Cavett Show. It was a talk show.
Yeah.
And so he had McDonald on, and in the course of McDonald relating the story, he essentially lambasted the Army prosecutors for trying to make him appear to be the culprit when there was so much evidence that he was the victim of the assault rather than the perpetrator. If you look at the presentation of first the Army CID and then later in the 1979 court trial, the case of the prosecutor is first wholly circumstantial. In other words, they're painting a picture based on what is known as circumstantial evidence. And the picture they would have the jury believe, and apparently the jury in 1979 did believe, is that McDonald staged the entire event. That he went into a rage because his two-year-old child had wet the bed, which is a common occurrence with any young parents. I don't think there are too many fathers who simply become so enraged by a wet bed that they then become Jack the Ripper and slaughter their wife and their two children. It would take an extraordinarily psychotic individual of a gross nature to have the capability of doing that. But that's what the prosecutors painted the picture of. They said that he had taking a we'll get into the role that an author by the name of Joe McGinnis played in helping cement the notion that McDonald was guilty in the public minds, at least in a minute or two. But the prosecution said that he became enraged by this bedwetting event, and that he got into an argument with his wife, and in the course of the argument, he simply went ballistic. He went nuts. He went berserk. And he slaughtered his wife and then the children. Now, McDonald himself had been clubbed a number of times, so much so that he was knocked unconscious. The first person to arrive in the house was about 4:30 a.m. morning was a military MP by the name of Kenneth Micah. And he discovered McDonald on the floor, laying next to his wife in a unconscious state, but sort of borderline by, he found them laying face down by turning McDonald over and doing CPR, blowing air into his lungs. He was able to bring McDonald around after a few minutes, and he asked McDonald what happened, and McDonald was asking not to worry about him checking his wife.
Let me stop you just for a second here.
Yes.
What's coming into mind? Who alerted the authorities?
Yes, okay, very good. McDonald had the chance to make phone calls after the killers had left. What had happened is that he was clubbed, he fell unconscious, but he recovered consciousness.
Okay.
And when he recovered, he, not fully, now mind you, he had not only been clubbed, he was stabbed 17 times, and one of the stab wounds had punctured, I think it's his right lung, sufficiently that it caused the lung to deflate. In other words, the mm-hmm. air leaked out of the lung, so he was only breathing with one lung.
Yeah.
Because later that morning, when he was taken to the hospital, they had to do an operation to close the wound in his lung and reinflate his right lung.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, of course, he lost some blood, I presume, too. But he was a strong man. He trained hard as a Green Beret. He was in good shape, so this probably played a big role in his ability to, plus his force of will. He wanted to try to save his wife. He didn't know, he was. So when he was first revived, he attempted to do CPR on his wife, and then, realized, the air was coming out, it was blowing in. She had so many stab wounds in her chest. He went to the kids, same deal. He in all cases, tried to perform CPR just to take a pulse, whatever. And when he realized that he's not getting any response, he made it to a phone, and he called the operator, and base operator, and told her to, you know, to send medical person. He gave the name, he gave the address, and the operator did not respond intelligently. She was asking stupid bureaucratic questions when he was desperate to try to see if he could save his wife. So he would talk to her for a few minutes, and he's screaming at her to send help, and she's saying, you know, you run into this sometime. You hear these people they use, you know, at 9/11 emergency centers, you know, have room temperature IQs, and they're asking people who are in desperate stress, well, calm down, sir. First, tell me your full, you know.
Yeah, give me your shoe size, where you went to school.
That idiocy, right. Yeah. So that's what he sort of encountered that night with this woman, this base operator who took his call. But so what she did is she reported it to the MPs as a possible domestic disturbance. Okay? So that's the reason the MPs came out there. They were not in a big hurry. In fact, he called, I'm guessing at the time now, the murders occurred between 2:15 and 3 a.m. He was knocked out to about 3:30 a.m. or so. And then he tried to check on his wife, and again, I'm guessing at the time, but around 3:40, 3:45 a.m., he made this call that I'm referring to now.
Now, it sounds to me like this this operator that he spoke to when he called for help was prepared for something to happen.
No, I would say, in my opinion, no. She was just...
In other words, she's stalling for time to you know, I don't know. Maybe I'm...
No, in my opinion, no. Threat, no. They had interviewed the woman later, and it was just at the moment. She didn't realize the gravity of the situation, and again, as these emergency people sometimes don't grasp...
Well, she was a genius, is what you're saying.
Right. So,
yeah.
You know, I forget what day of the week February 17th, 1970 was, but it's a weekday. It's an army base, and it's you know, it's 3:30 in the morning. So the type of people who work that shift, you know what I'm saying.
Yeah.
Okay. So she called possible. So the MPs, you know, weren't said, you know, a murder in progress. No. They thought, so they're taking their sweet time to first the dispatch the call. Then they finally send this guy out there. And on the way out there, Kenneth Mike, along with another man, sees a woman who fit the description of Helena Stokely to a T that night. She was wearing what was called a wide-brim floppy hat. She had a blonde wig on. She had white go-go boots on.
Like Squeaky Fromm.
Squeaky Fromm. It was lightly drizzling on and off that night. He sees her on a street corner about two blocks from the McDonald's apartment, and there's no one there. This is 4:30 in the morning.
Mm-hmm.
And had he not been on this call, Micah said later, he would have stopped and asked her some questions. But as it turns out, in my opinion, at least Fatal Justice opinion, the book, etc., believes it was Helena Stokely because its description fits her to a T of the way she was dressed that night. Okay, so they arrive at the scene. As I told you, they eventually resuscitated him, and then they take him to the hospital around 6 or so in the morning, I'm guessing at the time, but it was around there, and they start this investigation. Now, I won't go through all the details, but the lead investigator was a man named William Ivory, a young person. I think he was 24, 25, 26 years old at the time. I think this was his first murder investigation. And he later said at the Army hearing that within 15 minutes of his arrival, it was apparent to him that McDonald had set up the tipped over furniture and the other things to make it appear as if he was struggling, but that Ivory had decided that McDonald was probably the guy who committed these murders.
Now, was Ivory, do you think, at that point, was he the engineer of the train, or was he the signalman hanging off the edge of the caboose with the lantern?
No, I would say he was more of a signalman. I think what happened is that a decision was made by elements within the Army CID to not even entertain the possibility of looking for anyone else, but rather focus all of their efforts on looking at McDonnell. Now, the what they did is they notified McDonnell in April of that year, 1970, that they were looking at him as a suspect. Prior to that, McDonnell was not aware that the Army was, you know, was looking at him at all. He was cooperating with them fully, giving them every bit of information they asked for, and it was only when they told him that, you know, you're a suspect, that he then took steps to, you know, get an attorney and counsel and all that.
Now, let me ask a question, and this is pertinent to what you just said. The Army notifies him that he's a suspect, not the police. Was he living in a base house?
Well, that's what I'm saying, yes. He lived in an Army base housing.
Okay.
On the reservation of Fort Bragg. But as I mentioned, what's a little bit different about, you know, if you've ever been in the military, most military bases are surrounded by walls. You just can't walk in.
Mm-hmm.
But some of them are sort of semi-open to the public, and Fort Bragg is one of those. So there are public roads that anyone from the public can, you know, there's Dunkin' Donuts and McDonald's. So it's sort of a mixed public-military use, but it's nevertheless on U.S. Army property. It's still on Fort Bragg.
It's open like some country clubs are, you know, on the edges of the corpse or whatever.
So that's naturally how the coven, the killers, got to McDonald's house. They didn't have to go. Well, there might be a formal, you know, gate entrance, but anyone can drive through. There's no stopping and checking ID and who you're going to see like you normally encounter when you go on a military base. Usually you have to have permission. You know, you're going to see somebody. If you're a civilian, you just can't drive in. They have guards there to prevent you from entering.
This wasn't a random event. They definitely went there to get him.
Oh, it was planned.
Yeah.
It was,
there's no doubt about
it. Helena Stokely, as I mentioned to you earlier, her conscience weighed on her very heavily. Her and Greg Mitchell, and yet another party, a woman by the name of Kathy Perry, who's still alive as far as I know, she's probably in a mental institution in Florida, had told the FBI late 80s perhaps, or perhaps around 90, 91, but somewhere in that time range, she had talked to the FBI, because McDonnell had numerous appeals in which they tried to get more evidence to, you know, the prosecution was sitting and holding on a lot of evidence that could have exonerated McDonnell from the very beginning.
Uh-huh.
But they're playing this chess game. It doesn't matter that they're railroading an innocent man. It's more important to play this chess game of win at all cost. And in order to try to, particularly Helena Stokely, had tried over the years to tell the full story. She was even at the 1979 trial. She was subpoenaed to be there. She would have told everything that happened, who was responsible for the murders by name, had she been given immunity by the state. Or had she been given immunity by the federal government, the Department of Justice, that she would not have been prosecuted herself as a member, for conspiracy to be, because she was part of the group that murdered the Fifth family, she would have told them all. They adamantly refused to give her immunity. Now, there's a reason for that, and that's where the railroading part comes in.
Well, if the Army knew that she was involved, at least if the danger of that was there, certainly they would have no jurisdiction over her, would they? In other words, the local police?
No, they didn't have jurisdiction. What happened in 1979 is that there was an Army captain who, after McDonald's exoneration from the Army hearing in late summer of 1970, there was the Army people heard this interview that he did on Dick Cavett, in which he essentially lambasted them. And they, judging from their conduct in the aftermath of that, they apparently became livid that he had made them look bad on national TV, and they set out to get him. So the very people who were behind or setting him up for the attempted prosecution while in the Army transferred into civilian life. And one of those persons was a man by the name of Brian Murtaug, who's still with the Justice Department today. He transferred from the Army to the Justice Department and was specifically assigned to carry on an investigation of Jeffrey McDonald. Now, he was already acquitted by the Army. There was no justification to investigate him because the Army had already said, you know, the head of that hearing said, the man is free of any charges. He's free of any, not a wrongdoing, the charges against him were false, untrue.
And that's double jeopardy, isn't there?
Exactly, exactly.
Doesn't the Constitution and the Bill of Rights deal with that?
Yeah, more than that, you know, when you're in the military, you're on the military jurisdiction. When you're in civilian life, the military cannot pursue you. But that's exactly what they did in this case.
Okay.
And it was later that Murtaug transferred to the Justice Department, and then they started to work on setting it up so they can get a grand jury, which, as you know, is just presented information from one side. The defense has no opportunity to say anything. It's just a secret grand jury. So they indicted him in 75 after they took fully 5 years to set up a series of dominoes that they could get a grand jury to say, oh, yeah, well, there's probable cause there.
Mm-hmm.
They set him up all the way.
Now, during that time period, had any of the murderers died or disappeared?
Let's see. That's very interesting. According to Ted Gunderson, the leader of the group was a man by the name of Winterborn. He had a street name of Wizard. I have all the names of the people that Ted Gunderson felt were involved in the murder in an article I put on my website around 2005, I think, 2004. If you go to my
okay, I'm on your page right now.
Yeah, the railroading of Dr. Jeffrey McDonald. I give the main elements of the story in that page, but then within the link there, one of the links, and I forget which one, I'm sorry, I talk about the, I go into much greater detail about what Helena Stokely revealed. It's probably one of the links under Helena Stokely's name.
Mm-hmm.
And in one of those links, I list the names of the 8 individuals. So anyway, the leader of that group, a guy named Winterborn, Ted told me around 4 years ago, Ted Gunderson told me around 4 years ago, was dead. I already mentioned Greg Mitchell had died in 83. Helena Stokely mm-hmm. herself died in 1983, in January of 1983.
Yeah, I was referring to the time, you know, from the murder up until this grand jury indictment, in other words.
Well, frankly, I'm not sure. I know some of the individuals, I was told, at least to the latest information that Ted Gunderson had, some of the individuals are very much alive today.
Mm-hmm.
And there is a particularly intriguing individual who was identified by Helena as one of the people in the house who she was very afraid of. This man, his name is Alan Mazarell.
Mm-hmm.
Apparently he was a major player in this organization. He was involved in not only the satanic coven, but he was also involved in drug distribution and selling and dealing and all that, but on a large scale, because part of the reason that McDonald was chosen as the patsy, because the Army didn't want a real investigation to occur because they didn't want any of these coven satanic drug members discovered and arrested. Because had they been arrested and grilled, especially if civilian police, such as the Fayetteville police, or worse, the FBI. The FBI attempted to gain jurisdiction and investigate this case when it occurred, but the Army vigorously fought to prevent that and to keep it into Army jurisdiction. It had to do with a larger conspiracy, which McDonald's wife and McDonald's website and his defense team do not go into. So this is something that the McDonald team themselves do not explore or discuss publicly. They just wish to conduct their defense based on the facts of the case and not get into motivation and players and above all the conspiracy aspect. But I and Ted Gunderson and others do talk about the larger reasons we feel that the cover-up and the railroading occurred. It had to do with a phenomena that Helena Stokely revealed. Helena says that the big deal in railroading McDonald had to do with the fact that her group was involved with some people in the Army CID, some of the very people who were investigating and pointing to McDonald as the killer were themselves involved in drug dealing activities with the very members of this cult that were in McDonald's house the night of the murders. And that they were involved in a large distribution network up and down the East Coast. Where were they getting the drugs from? The drugs were being flown in from Southeast Asia, Vietnam, Cambodia, Laos, from what was known as the Golden Triangle at the time. That's where the poppies are grown, mm-hmm. Cocaine. Okay. And then the drugs were being, obviously, secretly inserted into the body cavities of GIs who were killed in Vietnam. So they were opening up the bodies in Vietnam, taking out some internal organs to make room, putting in bags and bags, sewing the body back up, putting the uniform back on the individual, putting him in the coffin. Now, it wasn't everybody and every coffin had drugs in, okay? It was certain selected bodies, certain coffins.
Yeah, I heard that they had a marking on them or something.
They had a marking system known to those involved. Now, I think, most of us know by now that the CIA is the biggest drug producers, cultivators, transporters, facilitators of drug traffic in the world. So naturally, the CIA was playing a big role in having created this pipeline. And they were sending these bodies back in Air Force transport planes, huge C-130s. And they landed at various bases around the country, but one of the bases they landed at is Pope Air Force Base, which just happens to be right next to Fort Bragg, North Carolina. So the bodies were coming in, and certain individuals who were part of the Military Air Transport Command, had the authority to check the planes and check the bodies, and they arranged to have certain coffins shifted off to this side, and others went that way, and then the drugs were surreptitiously removed, the body sewn back up, and then sent on to its final destination back to, the home of the person who was killed.
Mm-hmm.
So it was a huge operation. And had the Coven members been discovered, interrogated, especially by the FBI, these facts would have began to emerge, and they weren't going to allow that to happen. So therefore, that is what I'm and Ted Gunderson and others are saying was the reason why the CID... Because elements in the CID were themselves involved in drug trafficking, and particularly the lead investigator, William Ivory, knew the members of the cult. He knew Helena Stokely prior to the murder, and he went to see her to talk to her along with another investigator within days of the murder. And he did that in the desire to go through the formality of talking to her and not to really investigate, but to rather to set up a series of leading questions so that a platter was laid out for Helena to respond in a certain way so that she would essentially say, well, no, you know, I wasn't there, I wasn't involved. He wanted to elicit that kind of response, so if it at a later date, someone said, well, why didn't you, and he said, well, I did, we talked to her and blah, blah, blah. So we needed a cover.
Uh-huh.
So that's, so talk to her and set it up so that he could say, oh, yes, I talked to her, but, you know, she was cleared, blah, blah, blah. So he was getting, there was a strategy here in place, and it wasn't just William Ivory's. It was a number of people in the CID, but also Army brass. Helena Stokely said that it involved a number of officers on the base, up to and including two generals. So the corruption went very high in this, in people who were knowledgeable of this Vietnam drug pipeline, etc. Now, Helena Stokely's own father was a colonel in the Army. So, as long as the father was alive, even though Helena was trying her best to tell the story without indicting herself, the father would, you know, would of course say nothing himself. And as long as the father was alive, Helena Stokely's mother, who was told the true story by Helena on many occasions, couldn't say anything. It was only after the father had died.
Uh-huh.
And the mother of Helena Stokely herself was in her final months of life. She was in a nursing home at this time. Did the younger brother of Helena Stokely contact none other than the current Mrs. Catherine McDonald, the current wife of Jeff McDonald, and ask her that if she would like to come to North Carolina to talk to his mother, because the mother's willing to tell her what Helena admitted to her about her participation
mm-hmm.
that night. Catherine McDonald was asked when, and the young fellow said, well, how about now? So she dropped everything. She drove 13 miles from Maryland to North Carolina and interviewed the mother. At first, it was a little
13
rough.
Miles from Maryland to...
I'm sorry, I meant to say 13 hours.
Oh, okay.
She drove for 13 hours.
Okay.
And when she first arrived there, the son sort of indicated that maybe the meeting's not going to happen. So Catherine asked, well, can I at least talk to you? And so he did. And after talking to the son for an hour or two, the son became so affected by what Catherine had to say and her personality, etc., that he contacted his mother and essentially said, you've got to talk to this woman. So the meeting was set up. It happened. Apparently, Mrs. Stokely, while she was old and feeble, I was told, had a very, very sharp mind. I was told she was sharp as a tack. And after talking to Catherine for a couple hours, the mother agreed to allow an attorney to come in the room, an affidavit was taken, etc. And that statement is now posted on Jeff McDonald's website, which, by the way, I should give out now because it's important.
Yes.
Documentation, I have a lot of info, a lot of written on the McDonald case on my own website, but the most important site that has the best documentation is Jeff McDonald's own website. And the correct name of their website is themcdonaldcase.org. I'll repeat it, themcdonaldcase.org. And McDonald is spelled MacDonald.
Okay, now, if I can interrupt here.
Yeah, please.
You mentioned Alan Mazzarel.
Yes.
Well, I don't know if you've read this book, but I want to read something to you. It's written by Alex Constantine, published in 1995 by Farrell House in Portland, Oregon. It's available via mail, 221 pages. Alex Constantine, a fan of the late parapolitical researcher May Brussel, currently hosts a radio program for KAZU-FM in Monterey, California. In this book, he has brought together a collection of essays on the following topics: electromagnetic and telemetric mind control experimentation by intelligence agencies, often on involuntary subjects, Satanism and ritual cult abuse of children, also with an intelligence connection, and OSS CIA theft and profiteering for the purpose of funding covert operations. Specific case studies within these areas include the Strategic Defense Initiative as a cover story for mind control research, the McMartin preschool molestation case, the Jeffrey McDonald fatal vision murders, which we're talking about, the Children of God cult, the Larry King case in Omaha, NutraSweet and the Dumbing of America, and the secret appropriation of stolen Nazi art by the OSS. I think that would be a very interesting book to read, to see what he has to say about the case. And maybe we should consider getting him on this show.
Oh, Alex Constantine is an extraordinary researcher and writer. I have great admiration for him. He's absolutely top shelf.
Now, the majority of the cases that I read off here in this list are expert in the realm of expertise of Ted Gunderson, are they not?
Yes, you're absolutely right. I would say of Ted's post-retirement career, there are three really big cases, and one of them is the Jeffrey McDonald case. The other is McMartin, which is the other really big case because it involved so many children who were abused.
And the Larry King case, which is the
Larry King case was also known as the Franklin cover-up.
Right? Yeah.
Right, we're talking about not the radio talk show host Larry King, another man by the name.
Or the CNN talk show host now, too.
Right, CNN, right.
Yeah.
Anyway, I learned of the McDonald case through an introduction by Ted Gunderson. I was becoming aware of many aspects of the New World Order following, you know, my first venture into that subject by reading Bill Cooper's book, Behold a Pale Horse. I think I mentioned this before. Mm-hmm. Somewhere around late 94, 95, I read Bill Cooper's book. But around 96, 97, 98, 99, through that period, I attended different forums that are in the area. One of them is called the Freedom Forum, in which they have speakers, patriot-type speakers. And at one of those, I heard Ted Gunderson talk for the first time. And he began the talk, the first 10 or 15 minutes of his talk, briefly overviewing the Jeffrey McDonald case. And I come to find out later, because I've heard many talks by Ted, he begins every single one of his talks with the Jeffrey McDonald case, because he is so bothered by the fact that McDonald is completely innocent and that his whole life has been ruined. He's been in jail for 50 years. He was incarcerated in 79, and this is 2009. And he went from being a very good-looking, handsome, virile, highly talented doctor. He was a top-rate diagnostician, emergency room physician. He saved a lot of lives before he was in the, before he went to prison, even after he was in prison. He saved a number of lives in prison because of his skill as a doctor. And because Ted emphasized in his talk some of the elements that I'm bringing out tonight, that anyone who has intelligence and who seriously takes the time to examine all the evidence, you cannot arrive at any other conclusion but that McDonald was railroaded. And it's astounding to me how I continue to get an email here and there over the years. I've had this McDonald material on my website since at least 1999. I continue to get emails from people who, based on reading a book, a novel, really, written by Joe McGinnis called Fatal Vision. Joe McGinnis originally was hired by Jeff McDonald in 1979, in the early spring of 1979, to chronicle his case, so that prior to the trial, during, and what they thought would be an acquittal after the trial, McDonald wanted to have a way to earn enough money to pay his legal fees, because he had these huge legal fees, and because, you know, while he was a working doctor, the fees were humongous. So he thought if he can chronicle the whole case, he thought he was going to be acquitted. So Joe McGinnis already had a reputation as a writer, and he had forgotten the name of the book, but he had done a successful book somewhere around 76, 77. So he was a hotshot writer. I can't remember the name of the early book. It might come to me in a minute. So he hired him. And this is what happened. McGinnis was at the trial, of course. McGinnis was given a $250,000 advance on the book that he was going to write, explaining about all the attempts of the Army, having moved now into civilian life through working through Brian Murtaugh in the Department of Justice, had just, you know, this vindictive vendetta to try to nail an innocent man. He originally was going to title the book Acid and Rain. When McDonald was convicted, the publisher who gave McGinnis his $250,000 said, listen, we're not going to sell too many copies of a book that is claiming McDonald was railroaded when he was just convicted and his face is on the papers all over the country as the most diabolical, cold-hearted, psychotic killer in the history of the country. So he said, I want my money back. And McGinnis made a little deal. He said, well, let me rewrite it. So what he did is essentially hatched a private sweetheart deal that he would change the plot. And for the next 4 years, from 1979 to 1983, when the book came out and published, he continued to pretend to Jeffrey McDonald that he was his best friend, that he was going to help exonerate him when this book came out. And McDonald, believing this individual, gave him full access to all of his most private information. He gave him access to his condo, all his files, his family, his mother, for instance, everyone who knew him. Joe McGinnis had a red carpet laid out for him wherever he wanted to go in any aspect of McDonald's life. A wide open highway was given to him. What he was doing in that 4 years, however, was he was concocting a fiction, a novel, which he titled Fatal Vision.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the book came out, you know, 4 years after McDonald, you know, in 83, following, you know, 3.5 years following McDonald's conviction. Where it hurt McDonald is that the book not only was a big seller, because it's loaded with this lurid, you know, crazy killer, psychotic, you know, dramatic stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And because it was, quote, based on a real case, people, millions of people in this country especially, believed what that person wrote in that book to be true.
Mm-hmm.
And it was anything but. Joe McGinnis was proven to be a liar in 1986 when the McDonald defense team, on behalf of McDonald, sued him and his publisher and won a third of $1,350,000 from Joe McGinnis because they proved in court he's a liar and a confabulator and a tale teller.
Yeah, that to me, that book was sort of mop-up activity just to cement
the conviction that they had gotten, and to maintain the cover up that as to who, not just who was behind it, but who would have been affected by the knowledge of what was actually going on, had reached the public's consciousness. And we've heard stories, about the drug trade for, for since that time. So,
yeah.
That wasn't something new, but, heads would have rolled in some aspects, and they hadn't quite established full New World Order control over everyone yet, So, I'm just commenting on the fact that I see that the purpose for that book. And had this McGinnis ever written a book prior to that he should get a $250,000?
Well, yeah, actually, as I mentioned, I just can't remember it. I'm trying to. It was a very famous book. Whether it had to do with the Kennedy presidency, I'm trying to recall. He later did a book. This is, I think, in the late 80s, early 90s, on Ted Kennedy that was not well received by the Kennedy clan. And Joe McGinnis's, status as a favorite among, the more elite types in this country took a nosedive after that.
Mm-hmm.
But he should have taken a nosedive following Fatal Village vision, because he did much more harm to an innocent man. Harm in the sense that he cemented in the minds of the vast bulk of Americans who either saw the movie. There was a four-part miniseries that I think came out in 84. The book was 83. I think the miniseries was 84. And that movie, of course, based on the book, was also a fiction that paints McDonald as this psychotic killer. And that helped cement the public's, or the largest segment of the public's belief that he was guilty. I'll tell you an interesting story. Ted Gunderson talked to a man, Potter, who was one of the co-authors of the book that I referred to, that tells the true story of what happened. And it's the perfect rebuttal to the lies and the confabulations in Fatal Vision, called Fatal Justice.
Mm-hmm.
The reason Jerry Potter wrote the book is because Ted Gunderson convinced him that there was enough smoke or enough evidence that McDonald was being railroaded. Potter, in the beginning, Jerry Potter assumed, based on, the kind of the national mindset, thanks to Joe McGinnis's book and that mini TV show, he assumed McDonald was guilty. He said so, and he says so in the beginning of the book. He says how he first met Ted Gunderson. I think it was in Chinatown. It was a foggy night in San Francisco's Chinatown. It was really one of those 1930s type movies, scenarios. It was very intriguing the way he wrote his first meeting with Ted. But Ted told him enough, he made files available to him, that he sort of hooked Jerry Potter into looking into this. And once Jerry looked into it, and he met up with a very sharp ex-Green Beret journalist down in North Carolina, down in Fayetteville, by the name of Fred Boss. He teamed up with him because Boss is on the scene. He really knows the players there. And they co-wrote this book. It's a stunning book. It's a very important book because it does undo the many false notions that the Army set in motion, first with their Army hearing, but then the trial itself. There's many falsities that were created as a result of the trial and McGinnis's book that had to be undone to unravel what really happened. And Fatal Justice really does explain what happened. Now, they had hoped or assumed, the book was so important, so devastating to the lies, that the appeal process, which you have to realize that the judges in the case, there was a judge by the name of Dupree, who was at the original 79 trial. At subsequent opportunities, attempts at appeals had to continuously go through Dupree. And there was an absolute wall there.
Uh-huh.
I won't go into the details, but if you read Fatal Justice, Dupree is hardly has clean hands in all this matter. What's really weird is that his own son-in-law was the prosecutor. Of course, they never said that at the time. A guy named Proctor was the prosecutor in the first time around in 1970 with the army.
Mm-hmm.
So you had Dupree, and after Dupree died, another man took over in his stead, but he put up the same wall, a man named Fox.
Mm-hmm.
There was many, you need to read Fatal Justice to get the details. I don't want to go into it. It takes too much time to explain it.
Yeah.
But he was boxed out or screwed out of the appeal process in more than one way. But he had an opportunity when DNA analysis became widely used. They put in an application for DNA analysis. I don't have the year straight, but somehow the mid to late 90s is in my mind. 96, somewhere around there. 97, I'm not sure. If you go to Catherine McDonald's website, which again I was repeating is themcdonaldcase.org, you can click on a link there called Documents. And there she has the latest developments in her case from 2005 up to the present day, because there's a very encouraging development in her case, which I'll try to get to in a couple of minutes, because I know we only
have... Actually, we're about out of time here, so...
Okay, so then I'll say this then. To find out the latest developments, particularly a very revealing event took place in 2005, a former a U.S. Marshal by the name of Jimmy Britt was in a room with the state prosecutor during the 1979 trial. His name was James Blackburn. He's since disbarred for embezzlement. But at the time, he was the prosecutor. He was the state prosecutor and Brian Murtaugh was the Department of Justice, a co-prosecutor in the case. Jimmy Britt overheard James Blackburn threaten Helena Stokely that if she revealed anything on the stand that said that she was witness to people involved in the murder that night in McDonald's house, that he would indict her for murder. Now, that's against the law. You can't do that. Now, Jimmy Britt said that in 2005. He was diagnosed with cancer. He had already retired, and I guess he wanted to do something before he passed on. And this Judge Fox, who knew Jimmy Britt very well, Jimmy used to guard the judge, and knew him quite well, knew he was an honest man, did not act on his affidavit, which was given in 2005, in which he said, "I witnessed this event take place."
Uh-huh.
Nor did he act on the affidavit of the mother of Helena Stokely in time. He sat on the decision to allow an appeal for 3 years until both of them had died. And immediately after the death of Jimmy Britt, he says, "I'm not going to allow any of this information to affect my decision." So he denied an appeal opportunity. Fortunately, the Fourth Circuit, which has had a change of personnel, most conservative circuit court in the country, because of a change of personnel on that court, overruled Judge Fox just recently, and they said, "We're going to make available something known as a Certificate of Appealability, abbreviated a COA. And they're going to move on that in no less than 6 weeks from now. So if you go to the McDonald website and click on Documents, you can read all of these developments, beginning with Jimmy Britt's testimony in 2005, right down to the latest judgment. Catherine and Jeffrey McDonald are very optimistic that this appealability certificate will lead to an appeal that will lead to an error of a constitutional error, and in so doing may win Jeff's release. At least that's what they're hoping. So there's an exciting development here. I couldn't really get into the details, but you can read it by going to her website.
Well, in closing, if I can comment, it's quite obvious that there's a conspiracy to hide who is ultimately behind this. And I see the Army and the CIA and their illegal drug activities as at the core. And they used mind-controlled, drugged-out cult members to carry this out. The case, when I heard about it, reminded me instantly just the feeling of the Manson case. It had all the same types of characteristics to it, and many synchronicities, in fact.
Mm-hmm.
It's also quite similar to the Dr. Sam Shepard case that F. Lee Bailey tried on appeal. I think the same players are involved in these cases. In each case, there was evidence of satanic ritual involved, and you have to ask yourself the main question: why was this man framed? Or, as I used the term at the top of the show, and I wasn't aware that you had entitled your major piece on this, the railroading of Dr. Jeffrey Robert McDonald.
Wow, I didn't know that, Don. So you were doing that off the top of your head. Amazing.
Oh, yes.
What synchronicity? Wow.
Yeah, I just saw that on your site a few minutes ago when I was there. So certainly let's pick this topic up again if you choose to.
Oh, yes, I would like to.
Which is Tuesday, the 23rd of June, you'll be our guest again.
Okay.
Yeah, I have to apologize for the shortness of time, but
fine. This was our time slot, so we'll just pick it up again on the next time.
And I hope I asked the appropriate or the most intelligent questions one could ask, you know, with keeping in mind that we don't have all the details. I certainly don't, but I am somewhat familiar with the case, you know.
Yes, well, I do appreciate your repartee, only because, you know, when you're very familiar with a case, you tend to sometimes skip over huge areas because you're familiar with it. But I always have to remind myself that a listener who doesn't know anything about the case doesn't know. So it's very helpful that you will ask some things that maybe I've jumped ahead too far in the story.
Well, it's not the first such case that you and I have looked at, and it probably won't be the last, but certainly our prayers are with the McDonald's.
Yes.
And everyone who is actively trying to help them, whether they're out in front, in the front lines, or behind the scenes.
Right.
Okay, Ken, great show tonight. I look forward to seeing you, or at least talking with you, on Tuesday. Next week. In the meantime, folks, you have been listening to Evident Footprints on BBSRadio.com and our special guest, Ken Adachi. Please visit his website to learn more about this case and many, many other topics at educate-yourself.org. You can also visit my website at directlightproductions.com. And I have to let you folks know that my Alexa ranking within the last week jumped a million places. That's for my website. So I guess that's attributable to the listening audience to this show, as well as people that are just out there looking for the truth. If you haven't seen my site, by all means, go there. Again, directlightproductions.com. Special thanks to Don and Doug Newsom for making Evident Footprints possible, Seth Hendrick on the sound, and most of all, I thank you, the listening audience, for tuning in. Join us again tomorrow night for another great show with scientist inventor Jim Murray. In the meantime, I wish you a night filled with peace, love, and light, and have a good night.